That lines a Republican winning the race for governor in the U.S. state of Virginia, and a setback for President Biden ahead of next year's congressional elections. Syria says Israel has fired missiles toward a Damascus countryside for the second time in the past few days. Plus, Ethiopian authorities are asking residents in Addis Ababa to take up arms and defend their city amid fears that rebels from Tigray are advancing on the capital. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital Tehran. This is the World News. Our top story, it's election night in the U.S. with multiple polls underway in several key states, including the gubernatorial races in Virginia and New Jersey. In Virginia, Republican Glenn Youngkin is set to win the race against his Democratic rival, Terry McAuliffe. In New Jersey, Republican Jack Cittarelli is holding a lead over incumbent Democratic rival, Governor Phil Murphy. Meanwhile, mayoral races are also ongoing in several cities, including Atlanta, Boston, and Pittsburgh. New York City has elected Democrat Eric Adams as its new mayor. The polls are, in fact, putting the presidency of Joe Biden to test ahead of next year's midterm elections. Our correspondent Colin Campbell in Washington has been monitoring the situation for us. He says President Biden's growing unpopularity driven by his failure in Afghanistan and the economic concerns is, in fact, helping Republicans maintain a lead in the gubernatorial elections.
Yeah, right now we may be experiencing what some are calling the Trump effect, as we see that the former president may have had a influence on some of these elections, especially when we see the Republicans are coming out ahead in the state of Virginia and in New Jersey. Now, we did have a win from Eric Adams, who's a Democrat in New York, as far as New York mayor, the second African-American to hold that position. But we are looking at the governor races. And what's interesting is the disparity that we're seeing, where a lot of people thought that Democrats may surge ahead. But recently, we do have a president who is not that popular. Well, President Joe Biden is facing high disapproval numbers and low approval numbers, and he hasn't had very many wins lately. Let's take a look at what's been happening. We've had he had failures in Afghanistan when there was an attack where several service members were killed. We still have an economy that's still not up and running the way that people would like. We have issues when it comes to his infrastructure bill. It seems that pieces of the infrastructure bill keep getting taken out. And a lot of people are wondering what is going on with the promises coming from the Biden administration.
The Israeli military targeting the Damascus countryside with a second missile strike in just a few days. The airstrike was launched from the northern parts of the occupied Palestine earlier Wednesday. Syrian media are quoting military sources as saying that the strike targeted a post in the Zakia neighborhood near Damascus. The attack has caused some material damage, no word on possible casualties. Just days ago, Syrian air defenses intercepted Israeli surface-to-surface missiles over the same area. Two soldiers were injured in that attack. Israel frequently launches missile strikes on Syria. Damascus has been demanding action from the United Nations. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military sites as well as resistance fighters battling terrorists. Activist and political commentator Ken Stone says Israel's Western supporters embolden it to violate international law by allowing it to attack Syria with impunity.
Israel continues to do this in violation of international law because it has powerful backers which enable it to attack Syria, to overfly the sovereign territory of Lebanon, to mistreat the Palestinian people. And these enablers are to be found in Washington, in Ottawa, in London, in Paris, all the Western capitals. The reason that they allow this to go on in Syria is because even though their regime change attempt in Syria failed after 10 years, the U.S. coalition, which includes Canada, France, U.K., and Israel, is trying now to prevent Syria from getting back on its feet and reconstructing itself.
Palestinian families are turning down an Israeli proposed deal on their homes in a neighborhood in Al-Quds, saying the offer is only meant to justify the occupation at their expense.
We rejected the compromise offered to us by the court of the occupation, which considers us as protected tenants renting from the settlers organization and which will lead to the confiscation of our right in our lands. We reject because we believe in our cause and our right to our home and country, despite that we're not getting any guarantees to support our steadfastness as Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem from any side or organization.
Israel has for months been seeking to evict four Palestinian families from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and give their land to settlers. The families say the deal is unjust because it's meant to force them into recognizing the settlers' ownership of their lands. Hamas says rejecting the deal is the right decision to make and that by doing so, these families are avoiding the political traps set by Israel. Hamas is asking all Palestinians to support them. Israel's Supreme Court has proposed that the Palestinian families remain in their homes for 15 years in exchange for rent. They were given until November 2nd, that is, to make their decision. Mona Kandil is joining us now from Ramallah with more details on the Sheikh Jarrah evictions. Mona, tell us more about this proposed deal by the Israeli regime and also the response that the Palestinian families have given.
Well, Israeli settler organization have been trying to prove that they have an ownership for the land where four Palestinian families live in Sheikh Jarrah. We have to say that those families came from lands occupied in 1948. They were transferred to Al-Quds, to a Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, and they were living there. Now, after months, the Israeli court in October, Israeli Supreme Court proposed a deal for those four Palestinian families, saying that they can remain in their homes only for 15 years as a protected tenants while paying rents to the settler groups who have claimed the land. The Israeli court gave those Palestinian families a period until November the 2nd, that was Tuesday yesterday, in order to respond. But the Palestinian families said they refuse this compromise and they are insisting to remain in their homes, rejecting this deal and saying that they have the right to remain in their homes. Otherwise, if the Israeli regime insisted to take them out of their homes, then they have the right to return to their real homes. Their real homes are in the lands that were occupied in 1948. They are now urging the international community to intervene. They are saying that the Palestinians across the occupied territories in Al-Quds should stand with them, and this is what's going on. Palestinians are saying that the Israeli court's decision is illegal, and they support the Palestinian families, and they will continue to protect them to remain in their homes. But the fear is now that this refusal, the family's refusal of the Israeli decision might cause clashes between other settlers living in illegally living in their homes inside the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. But up to the moment, the Palestinian families made their decision clear. They will not leave their homes, and they will not accept the Israeli court's decision to pay rents for settler groups for 15 years, because after 15 years, this means that they will be forced to leave their homes and that the Israeli regime will confiscate the land and the homes and to bring settlers to illegally live instead of them.
Let's focus a little bit on the deal itself, Mona. Do you think that the Israelis, in spite of all the international pressure that they did see, the international, I wouldn't say pressure, but the reactions that they saw with regards to the Sheikh Jarrah evictions, they are in a way trying to legitimize this form of occupation and the land grab in those specific areas?
Well, yes, not only in Sheikh Jarrah, in other areas in the occupied West Bank and in Al-Quds, the Israeli forces can steal Palestinian lands and annex them to illegal settlements, saying that sometimes Palestinians are not living in these lands, but the fact is that the Israeli regime itself prevents people to live in areas, let's say these areas are very, very close to the illegal settlements, or even areas in Al-Quds, very close to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the old town of Al-Quds. So they try to deceive the world by saying that these homes and these lands are left alone without Palestinians living there, or sometimes the lands must be used for military purposes and they can confiscate the land. But this time the people are living in their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. They are saying that they were living there since 1948 up till the moment. How come an Israeli settler group organization comes after all these years and say they have documents for ownership of the land? If this is a true, as Palestinians are saying, or the owners of these homes are saying, then if this is a true, then they have the right to return to their lands they were expelled from in 1948. Now Palestinians would remain in their homes. Experts are saying if the Israeli regime insists on its decision, then they will take them by force from their homes. However, people are urging other Palestinians across the occupied territories to come and remain with them, protect them, and support them against this illegal law.
Thanks a lot, Monab Kandil, joining us from Ramallah. Elsewhere, it's been 104 years since British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his infamous declaration giving Israeli settlers the permission to usurp Palestinian land. Asher Shannon has more in this following report.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip marked the 104th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. They also expressed their anger towards the British government and its continued support to the Israeli regime. In 1917, then-British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his declaration giving Zionists the permission to usurp Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration led to the displacement of the indigenous Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948. Hamas movement vowed to continue resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The Palestinian people are still suffering from the repercussions of the ill-fated Balfour Declaration, which created a Zionist entity on holy Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration will be trampled upon by the Palestinian people. After 104 years, we maintain that all form of resistance will be used to liberate all of the historic land of Palestine.
Palestinian refugees, who make up most of Gaza's population, demanded compensation from the British government for the pain and suffering for more than seven decades.
We want to liberate the land of Palestine and return to the towns and villages from which we were expelled. The Zionists have no rights here and have no place in our land.
The United Kingdom, along with the United States, have been the strongest supporters of the Israeli regime. Senior Palestinian officials demanded that the British government must compensate Palestinians for the grave pain and loss.
Britain has started our misery, and the United States has taken it upon itself to continue this injustice by supporting the Zionist occupation and giving it the green light to violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Both Britain and the United States have been making attempts to turn the Israeli regime into a military superpower.
104 years on, the Balfour Declaration continues to plague all aspects of life for Palestinians. The Balfour Declaration is considered by most Palestinians as the root cause of their suffering under the Israeli occupation. They also blame England for their plight. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Ethiopia declares a nationwide state of emergency amid fears that rebels from the northern region of Tigray are heading for the capital. The government has also ordered residents of Addis Ababa to prepare to defend their neighborhoods. This follows days of reported advances by forces of the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Ethiopian lawmakers are expected to approve this state of emergency within 24 hours, while further possible restrictions include a curfew, road closures, and searching people suspected of links to terror groups. Thousands of people have lost their lives since the government launched an offensive against rebel forces in Tigray. Political commentator Lawrence Freeman says the U.S. support for rebels in Tigray instead of the Ethiopian government has prolonged insecurity in the country.
The Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, is acting to overthrow the government of the duly elected Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and has been tacitly supported by the West. If not for the attacks by the U.S. government and Biden administration on the Prime Minister in Ethiopia and tacit support for TPLF, this effort by the Tigrayan insurrectionists would have died off months and months ago. And therefore, the correct policy should be for the United States, instead of threatening more sanctions, should be to support the nation-state of Ethiopia. And that's what all nations and all people of goodwill should be doing. If Ethiopia breaks apart or begins to break apart, this would be a disaster for the Horn of Africa, but also for the rest of the world, because it would heighten the insecurity problem in Africa.
Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for a deadly attack on Afghanistan's biggest military hospital. On Tuesday, gunmen stormed the hospital grounds after two suicide bombers set off heavy explosions at the site in central Kabul. The Taliban said four gunmen were killed, while a fifth one was captured. At least 25 people were killed in the attack, and more than 50 others injured. Daesh terrorists have stepped up their operations in Afghanistan in recent weeks. They have particularly targeted the country's Shia minority, killing scores of them in Kandahar and Kunduz provinces. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal says a growing number of U.S.-trained former soldiers are joining the terror group. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg believes that the United States is responsible for the creation of the Daesh terror group.
Well, this has been going on since the U.S. started backing the Mujahideen in 1978. They were actually busy from then. As the U.S. invaded Iraq, it was clear that it was going to set up ISIS. I mean, it's almost as if the U.S. was showing its hand completely. That invasion of Iraq created a huge new generation of ISIS. And then now, the invasion of Afghanistan 20 years, it's incubated into this so-called Khorasan, an eastern Turkestan version of ISIS. Now, and it's not at all a spontaneously formed group. This is a group that is also has its CIA, whatever, Mossad elements that are shaping it and pushing it towards further terrorism.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. The UK is one of the principal states fueling the war in Yemen by providing arms to the Saudi-led coalition. Dear listeners, we have prepared an article for you in this regard written by Maureen Claire Murphy Ryder. This article is published under the heading Weapons Trade with Saudis and Israeli Regime Must Be Disrupted. Stay tuned for more. Earlier this month, the UN Human Rights Council voted to reject a resolution extending an independent expert review of the human rights situation in Yemen by another 2 years. The resolution proposed by the Netherlands was the first to be defeated in the Council's 15 years of existence. It was supported by the principal Western suppliers of weapons to the Saudi-led coalition waging war against Yemen, but it seems not with the same vigor as it was opposed by Saudi Arabia. The Reuters news agency called it a defeat for Western states on the Council, though many of those same states will continue to profit from the war their arms are fueling in Yemen. Media outlets blamed the dashed resolution on intensive lobbying by Saudi Arabia and its proxy Bahrain, a voting member of the Council. UN member states have given a green light to warring parties to continue their campaign of death and destruction in Yemen. Radia Al-Mutawakkil, a representative of the Yemeni group M. Watna for Human Rights, told media. The UK is one of the principal states fueling the war in Yemen by providing arms to the Saudi-led coalition. The London government voted in favor of extending the mandate of the international experts investigating suspected war crimes in Yemen, some of it perpetrated with British-supplied arms. Put simply, the UK supports examining grave human rights abuses in Yemen while it provides the weapons, which it knows will be used to commit war crimes. Britain certainly has not listened to the recommendations of the experts to stop fueling the conflict by halting arms transfers. The UK is second only to the US in supplying arms to the Saudi-led coalition. Fragments of US-made weapons have been found in almost all air strikes investigated by human rights activists. In one report by the Yemeni human rights group M. Batana, it was stated that U.S.-made weapons had been used in 25 out of 27 Saudi airstrikes identified. Every one of those airstrikes targeted civilians in Yemen. The third main supplier of weapons to the coalition is France, which, like the U.K., voted in favor of the renewing of the U.N. independent experts' mandate. The strategy underpinning Saudi tactics is the same used by the Zionist regime to foment regime change in Gaza, with the blessing of Washington, Brussels, and the political wing of the United Nations. The Saudis and Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi, Yemen's president in exile, seem to believe that if they force those living under the Ansarullah rule to suffer, they will overthrow the rulers, the authors of the Brookings Institution article on Yemen claim. Yet this same strategy has failed for the past 15 years of the U.S. sanctions on Venezuela, 40 years of U.S. sanctions on Iran, and 60 years of U.S. sanctions on Cuba. Though the U.S. economic warfare has failed to yield the desired regime change results, this strategy has caused great harm to average people living in those states, to say the least, as has the Zionist regime siege on Gaza. The world's top 11 arms exporters have all transferred weapons to parties to the Yemeni war. In addition to the US, UK and France, substantial suppliers include Germany, Spain, Italy and the Netherlands. The Zionist regime and Ukraine have also provided arms supplies, according to a report by Sam Perlow Freeman published by the World Peace Foundation covering 2009 to 2018. Roger Carr from BAE Systems said in 2019, civilians are killed in war. The solution is to stop wars at the earliest opportunity. And our belief is that if you supply first-class equipment, you are the encouragement, particularly when used in defense, for people to stop fighting. That has certainly not been the case in Yemen. Not only have these arms transfers fueled conflict, but they also violate the laws of many of the states exporting them. The US, UK and France have arms export rules to prevent the transfer of arms that might worsen conflict or be used for human rights or international humanitarian law violations, as observed in the World Peace Foundation report. Those rules have failed to prevent those states from exporting arms to parties that created the world's worst humanitarian crisis. As the World Peace Foundation report states, there is frequently a gap between many states' willingness to commit to strong arms export controls and a willingness to restrict their arms exports in practice. Instead, states' defense, foreign policy, and military-industrial interests take center stage. That deference to national interests at the expense of justice is evident in the failure to censure or sanction Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi Crown Prince and Minister of Defense, who bears principal responsibility for his country's actions in Yemen. The White House's National Security Advisor recently courted bin Salman to advance Saudi normalization with the Zionist regime, despite Biden's campaign pledge to make a pariah out of the Crown Prince over his role in the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. In contrast, the UN Security Council has imposed sanctions on Ansarullah movement. The Netherlands voted to ban arms exports to Saudi Arabia in 2016, but Dutch banks continue to invest in weapons makers supplying the conflict, and its major pension funds finance human rights violations in Yemen and beyond. Ending arms sales is the single most effective step the US and UK can take towards ending the war, as Perlow Freeman observed in the New Internationalist earlier this year. Without the support of the US and UK arms manufacturers, the Saudi Air Force would be grounded in a matter of days, as a former BAE Systems employee has said. Yet, world powers carry on with arms deals as usual while gesturing towards a rules-based international order to which they pay little more than lip service. So why do these states even bother to international human rights bodies? Making a pretense of caring about human rights is necessary to functioning of a system actually intended to impose imperial will. And so Western countries vote in favor of toothless probes into rights violations in Yemen and Gaza, while lavishing weapons on Saudi Arabia and the Zionist regime, and providing support to maintain their advanced weapons systems. So long as there is profit to be reaped, neither the emergence of conflict nor 30 states' domestic laws will do much to restrain weapons transfers. Earnest appeals by independent investigators to the non-existent morality of weapons exporting UN member states is sadly hardly more effective. This is not to say that their work is not necessary and should not be supported. Their reportage informs the advocacy work of those genuinely concerned with human rights and willing to put their bodies on the line to defend them. Activists carrying out direct actions to disrupt the arms trade have punctured the vacuum of accountability by imposing a cost, even if it is just in terms of public image, on heightening the complicity of corporations profiting from the bloodshed in Yemen and Gaza. Divestment campaigns may also advance public consciousness and build international solidarity with peoples resisting regimes supported by Western liberal regimes.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israel is perpetuating its land grab policy in the occupied Palestinian territories under the nose of the international community. According to a UN report, demolition and confiscation of homes in the West Bank and Al-Quds have increased by 21% compared to the previous year. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has also reported a 28% rise in the number of Palestinians displaced in the same period. Some 310 structures have been seized only in Area C on short notice or without advance warning. Area C accounts for more than 60% of the occupied West Bank. Well, it doesn't stop here. Israel has also unveiled plans to build some 3,000 more settler units in the West Bank. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let me introduce our guests in this edition. We'll have member of the European Parliament from Ireland South, Mick Wallace, who's joining us out of Brussels. Also, Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, is joining us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome our guests, but let's first go to our correspondent in Occupied Ramallah, Mona Candela, is there. Let's ask Mona for an update on the latest Israeli settlement expansion policy. Mona, go ahead.
Well, it seems that Israel is still insisting that it deals as a state above the law. It ignores all the international demands, that settlement is illegal across the occupied West Bank and in Al-Quds. There were demands by the international community for Israel to stop immediately all kind of settlement activity. However, the Israelis know that they got the support from former U.S. President Donald Trump. They got a green light to continue settlement activity, and here we are seeing first the Israeli regime approved 3,000 settler units across the occupied West Bank. Several days later, it approved over 1,700 settler units across the occupied West Bank, in addition to approving the construction of two new settlements inside the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. It was the first approval for settlements in 20 years in that area, and they know that they will not receive nothing but condemnations and demands to stop the settlement activity. They know that they won't receive any sanctions. That's why they are ready to approve more settlement units, and they would be annexing more Palestinian lands to the illegal settlements and seizing more Palestinian lands illegally.
Okay, thanks for that, Simona Kandel, correspondent in Ramallah. Now, let me put the first question to Mick Wallace in Brussels. Mick, as you see statistics clearly indicating that the Tel Aviv regime is pushing ahead with its illegal settlement building on Palestinian land, grabbing more and more land, rendering more Palestinians homeless. So let's start by talking about the main factors leading to this rising settlement expansion.
Yeah, look, there's probably nothing unusual about it in the sense that it's kind of what we expect. The Americans, as your previous speaker said, give a blank check to the Israelis to do whatever they like. And there's a number of reasons for that, obviously, which we probably haven't had time to go into. But clearly, everyone knows that it suits the Americans to have a satellite state like Israel in the region. And it's no surprise, given that America has been pretty lawless for many, many years themselves and have had little or no respect for international law, there's nothing unusual about the fact that they allow Israel to totally disrespect international law as well, of which the settlements are part of. But I think what's really crucial as well, though, is the fact that the EU are complicit. And it was probably never as obvious as in the recent war where Israel was bombarding Palestine and the EU were refusing to condemn it. I mean, you had a situation where the president of the European Commission, von der Leyen, came out and condemned Hamas rockets for killing two children in Israel, but refused to condemn Israelis killing 66 children in Palestine. Now, I mean, it is so blatantly bad that it's embarrassing for European citizens at this stage. But I would insist that the EU complicity gives Israel a lot more authority and power to behave as badly as they do around the settlements because of the EU support.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, let me ask Mr. Bangash about Washington's unflinching support for the Tel Aviv region, how much it has been responsible in actually for incentivizing the Tel Aviv regime to turn a deaf ear to global condemnation and continue building more and more settlements.
Well, as long as the United States government, regardless of what persuasion, political persuasion it may be, whether Democratic or Republican, continue to finance this illegitimate Zionist entity, this settler colonial entity in Palestine, obviously there is no incentive for the Israelis to stop their aggressive settlement policy. They go further, of course. They go and barge into Palestinian homes. They attack Palestinian families. There are at least 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli prisons, including hundreds of women and children that are even threatened with sexual violence. They continue. This is all very well documented. Amnesty International has said it. Human Rights Watch has said it. Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, they published reports regarding all of these things. Right. And yet Israel continues because of the U.S. underwriting of its illegal criminal activities of settlement expansion. We need to keep in mind that today only 8% of the Palestinian territory is left for the Palestinian people. You know, the West Bank is under military occupation. The Gaza Strip is a vast open-air prison. And even the Palestinians living inside what is referred to as the Green Line, which is the 1948 border, their rights are being disturbed. There are dozens of laws that constrain the rights of the Palestinian people there. Mm-hmm. And of course, then we see Israeli encroachment in Jerusalem, on Masjid al-Aqsa, etc. So when you put all of these things together, it is evident that America is basically underwriting Israeli crimes, and America is complicit in it. In fact, I would say virtually the entire Western world, with the exception of, for instance, Ireland,
we'll come to that at a later point. Yeah, you're right. Okay, now, Mick, there was another measure that Washington took in the name of helping the Palestinian, helping resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, Mick, and that was putting forward the so-called deal of the century. And you know how Palestinians regard it, what kind of a deal that was. It was total bias toward Israel, and it simply further deprived the Palestinians of their rights. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, if it wasn't so sad, you would have said it was a joke. The deal of the century was, I mean, how anyone could even speak about it with a straight face was actually surprising. First of all, it was given Israel total security. It was allowing Israel control over international borders of Palestine. It was doing away with, once and for all, the right of return, which is absolutely vital to the Palestinians. And obviously, it was harping back to the two-state solution, which, from my perspective, is dead. The two-state solution has been killed off. And it's obviously been killed off on purpose. And sadly, the Americans and the EU still plays lip service to it as if this is a way forward when we know it isn't. Also, of course, another part of the deal of the century was that the Palestinians would be responsible for the suppression of Palestinian movements that might be in opposition to Israel. Well, I mean, that's actually in place already, because sadly, the Palestinian Authority, as far as I'm concerned, are part of the problem and are not part of the solution. And they work as like a security force for the Israelis and the Americans, and are funded by them. So that's already in place. But no, the deal of the century was an absolute shambles, and it makes a mockery of any notion of a settlement going forward. Absolute nonsense.
Yep. Mr. Bangash, 104 years ago today, we had this declaration of Balfour that was issued by the British government, and you mentioned the Western world in this, and the facility of the immigration of European Jews to Palestine, and many believe it was a major catalyst of the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948. Do you share the same view?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Balfour had no right, the British government had no right to promise the land of the Palestinian people to the Jewish people. Of course, it was Europe for much of its history that has persecuted the Jewish people, and whenever they were persecuted, the Jewish people would seek refuge among the Muslims. And we as Muslims are proud of the fact that we have never persecuted the Jewish people, and we shouldn't. But regrettably, what Balfour did as Foreign Secretary of Britain at the time is to promise in a letter, it's a short letter, promised to the Jewish leaders that the British government would facilitate the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. Of course, it did also had a rider that, you know, nothing should be done to affect the religious and social rights of the Palestinian people, but there was no such mention of their own state. Now, the Palestinian people were not even consulted. And the reason for the Balfour Declaration was that the First World War was going on and Britain was keen to get America involved in the war, and until that time, America had not intervened. And the British basically promised to Lord Rothschild, who was a very well-known banker in the United States, he had connections all over with the American elite, and in return for this promise, Rothschild was supposed to get American help in joining the war to defeat Germany. And that is exactly what took place. So it was a conspiracy at several levels. Mm-hmm. The worst of it was that the Palestinians' homeland, without their consultation, they were an overwhelming majority in 1917. In fact, the census done in 1912 showed that there were only 6% people of the Jewish faith, and the other 94% were basically Palestinians, the overwhelming majority Muslims, and a few Christians. And yet, they were not even consulted about what their who their land was going to be given to. So right. That great disaster is the one that ultimately led to the Nakba and the destruction of about 530 villages and towns in Palestine, thousands of Palestinians killed, and about 750,000 Palestinians ethnically cleansed in 1948.
Right. Now, Mick Wallace, Britain was not alone. It enjoyed the backing of the U.S. and France in the Balfour Declaration that resulted in the expulsion of, as Mr. Bangar said, some 750,000 Palestinians from their homeland. Now, more than 100 years pass, 104 years exactly. Have things changed in terms of Western support for Israel and its occupation of Palestine and land grab and all that?
No, listen. The story 104 years ago and the story today is pretty similar. They might do things with a prettier face these days, and they put a better face on things sometimes. But empire does as it sees fit, and they show no mercy, or they show no respect for the rights of what would be regarded as the smaller nations anywhere. But it should be noted that at the time, in that letter that Balfour wrote to Rothschild, he actually, in the short letter, he actually said, "It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine." Now, obviously, they knew bloody well that there would be trouble coming from this. And there's a very interesting quote. I mean, obviously, the fact that I'm Irish, it was something that I found very interesting. But the first British governor of Jerusalem, a fellow called Ronald Storrs, he described this arrangement, the Balfour arrangement, as and the idea of expanding the Zionist projects, allowing the Israelis to go in there and gradually take over the place. He described it as a little loyal Jewish Ulster in a sea of potentially hostile Arabism. Now, I mean, for an Irish person, that carries a lot of significance. And it was interesting. You know, there was a general UN General Assembly resolution in 1975. I think it was number 3379. It was by a fellow called Fayez Syed. And he says that it was when this happened back in 1917, he says the reciprocal interests had thus come to bind British imperialism and Zionist colonialism. Because you should remember that the Brits had other ideas at place as well, and the Suez Canal was a big factor. And the idea that they would have a foothold just in case relations with the native population, in case it turned sour at any stage, they felt that having a foothold there by planting Jews there, they felt that it would probably strengthen their capacity to hold on to the Suez Canal influence, because that was vital for the Brits at the time, especially with all their trade with India. But controlling the Suez Canal was paramount for them. And this was also seen as a way of strengthening their hold on the Suez Canal.
Right. Now, Mr. Bangladesh, you talk about complicity on the part of the U.S. and maybe some European countries. It's not that only. We have also a number of Arab states that have signed these so-called normalization deals with the Tel Aviv regime instead of standing by Palestinians. So how has that emboldened the Tel Aviv regime to go on usurping more Palestinian land?
Well, that's exactly what it is. These Arab regimes, without even consulting the Palestinian people, went ahead with their so-called normalization process. We need to keep in mind two points. Number one, that the Palestinians were never consulted, and the Palestinians actually condemned this normalization process. So that's the first thing. Secondly, when we look at these Arab regimes, these were again creation of British colonial intrigue. Back in 1916 and so on, Britain and France went about their intriguing ways to divide the Middle East into various statelets and so on. Out of that emerged Saudi Arabia and later on countries like Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, and so on. These countries actually never existed before. These were basically tribes, little tribes, essentially with a tent and a camel outside. And of course, oil, once it was discovered, became a big issue. And the British and the French went about creating these regimes, which had no legitimacy whatsoever, but they served British imperial interests. We need to keep in mind that it was Ben-Gurion, the first Prime Minister of Israel, who said that the Arab regimes are the first line of defense of Israel. Now, I think he had said that back in 1948. Right. And today, we see that these Arab regimes are, in fact, they have become complicit with Zionist crimes, Zionist settlement policy, Zionist expansionism, because these regimes were created for that purpose. And they have stabbed the Palestinian people in the back. So much so that they have even abandoned Masjid al-Aqsa, which is the third holiest place, the first Qibla of the Muslims.
Right.
I mean, if these Arab regimes had any self-respect or dignity, they would not do such a thing. But obviously, we know that they don't have any self-respect, they don't have any dignity. They are simply agents of imperialism and colonialism, and now they have become agents of Zionism as well.
Okay. Now, Mick Wallace, you know that agreements haven't helped the Palestinians. They've not been able to restore their rights. International organizations haven't been able to do much. Mediation hasn't worked. Palestinians have just lost more lives, more land, and they've been deprived of their rights over the years. So what's the way forward for them now?
Well, I suppose, obviously, being a member of the European Parliament, I'm very conscious of the fact that the European Parliament talks about human rights and the rights of all the different groups across the world to live, the right to live a good life in good conditions. But yet, what we see is we see the EU and the Americans as being very selective as to whose human rights they care about. Mm-hmm. Right now, we become obsessed with the human rights of the people in Belarus. Now, it's obviously not a coincidence that it's on the Russian border, and NATO wants to further undermine the security of Russia by encroaching more on Belarus, but the very fact that they had been oblivious to the terrible suffering inflicted on the Palestinian people by the apartheid state of Israel for so long now, it really exposes the hypocrisy of the European Union. And I mean, if you ask me, I mean, what's the way forward? I mean, for me, we can forget about a two-state solution. The way forward now is where it's all one country and is run in a democratic fashion. Mm-hmm. There's human rights for everybody, whether they're Israelis or Palestinians or anybody else. It would have to include the right of return for all Palestinians. But it would be a place where everyone would live a decent life.
Right.
And obviously, right now, Israel, that wouldn't suit them, because Zionism, I mean, it is... Now, it's not just a colonial project, it's a racist project.
Right.
And
given their racist nature, they don't want to go to that space, but it's up to the likes of the European Union to push them there.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Let me thank our guests. We had a member of the European Parliament from Ireland South, Mick Wallace, in Brussels, and director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, in Toronto. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام ما خير بخير بعده النار وما شر بشر بعده الجنة وكل نعيم دون الجنة فهو محقور وكل بلاء دون النار عافية.
Imam Ali said, that good is no good after which there is the fire, and that hardship is no hardship after which there is paradise. Every bliss other than paradise is inferior, and every calamity other than the fire is comfort.